This is VOA News. Reporting via remote, I'm Jeff Custer. Ukrainian officials Tuesday are conceding that Russian forces now control about 80% of the eastern Luhansk region, but the fighting for the region's industrial city of Severodonetsk continues. The city's mayor, Alexander Stryuk, told Ukrainian television Tuesday the country's defenders are doing everything possible to hold their positions in the city, even as Russia sends in more troops. And reports from Severodonetsk say the fighting is going street by street, block by block. From Kiev, reporter Anna Chernikova tells VOA Severodonetsk would be a difficult city for any force to hold.
This is a specific of this town of Severodonetsk. There is no other way that forces can just take over the city. It's quite big. It's industrial city. There are a lot of plants there. And, well, it's, you know, it's kind of, it's not an easy landscape as well. So this is exactly what we're hearing, that there are artillery fightings. Basically, we can call it artillery duels happening in the city. And unfortunately, what we also can see that the city is kind of burned down, and the situation with the infrastructure and with the civilian areas in particular is very similar to Mariupol. The city is almost completely destroyed, unfortunately.
The battle for Severodonetsk is said to be one of the bloodiest of the war so far. Chernikova reports that while Russia may control 8% of Luhansk region, Ukrainian officials tell her other cities in the region would be similar to Severodonetsk in that they would be difficult for Russia to hold or advance from in the coming days. This is VOA News. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said Tuesday Poland will get no money from an EU pandemic relief fund until the right-wing government there rolls back measures deemed to limit the independence of the country's judiciary. Poland is in line to receive nearly 360 billion euros to help its economy recover from the COVID-19 pandemic. But the EU has frozen its access to the funds amid concern about political control over the judiciary. The commission insists that a disciplinary chamber for Poland judges should be abolished, that its rulebook be rewritten, and that judges sanctioned by the chamber have their cases reviewed. Von der Leyen told EU lawmakers Tuesday that no money will be dispersed until these reforms are undertaken. Some lawmakers, however, have expressed skepticism. Changes in spending habits among U.S. consumers have forced some major retailers to implement changes in the way they're doing business. Associated Press correspondent Jennifer King has details.
Minneapolis-based Target has announced it is canceling orders from suppliers and slashing prices to clear out more home goods and clothing after underestimating how quickly shoppers would shift their spending habits in the past few months. Target's profit for the fiscal first quarter tumbled 52% compared with the same period last year, a trend seen in filings from a number of major retailers. Pandemic favorites like big TVs, furniture, kitchen appliances, and comfy clothing are giving way to travel, dining, groceries, dressier clothes, and makeup. Target's chief financial officer tells the Associated Press, retail inventories are elevated in some of the categories that they misforecast, and they're acting aggressively to get business back on track. It marks a reversal from the past 2 years when retailers were scrambling to bring in goods that were stuck in supply chain bottlenecks. I'm Jennifer King.
The U.S. House of Representatives Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol will go public with its findings beginning this week. Lawmakers hope to show the American public how democracy came to the brink of disaster. The series of hearings that will take place over the next several weeks will begin with a live televised hearing Thursday evening in which the nine-member panel plans to give an overview of its 11-month investigation. More than 1,000 people have been interviewed by the panel, and only snippets of that testimony have been revealed to the public, mostly through court filings. Meanwhile, the Department of Homeland Security says a looming Supreme Court decision on abortion, an increase of migrants at the U.S.-Mexican border, and the midterm elections are potential triggers for what they see as extremist violence over the next 6 months. Repeating the hour's top story, Ukrainian officials Tuesday are conceding that Russian forces now control about 80% of the eastern Luhansk region, but fighting for the industrial city of Severodonetsk in Luhansk continues. Reporting via remote, I'm Jeff Custer. This.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
This exercise is very important for us in the East African community, because if we don't do that, some people are going to swallow us.
That was Lieutenant General Peter Eliwelu, Deputy Chief of Uganda's Defense Forces, on the Six Nation military exercise currently underway that is aimed at cooperation and security operations in East Africa. Details coming up. Also, the Nigerian town of Uwo is slowly recovering from the stunning attack on a church during Mass last Sunday. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. UN agencies are warning of famine in Somalia and a surge of child deaths across the Horn of Africa if their appeals for urgently needed funds to save the lives of hundreds of thousands of hungry, malnourished children remain unmet. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The Horn of Africa is experiencing its fourth consecutive year of failed rains, a climate event not seen in at least 40 years. If the drought persists, the World Food Program warns as many as 20 million people will be suffering from acute hunger by the end of the year. UNICEF reports more than 1.7 million children across Ethiopia, Kenya, and Somalia are in urgent need of treatment for severe acute malnutrition, the deadliest form of the condition. Rania Dagash Kamara is UNICEF Deputy Regional Director, Eastern and Southern Africa. Speaking from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, she says the risks are particularly high for children in Somalia who now are living on the front lines of the climate crisis.
We have an estimated 386,000 children in Somalia who are in desperate need of treatment for life-threatening severe acute malnutrition. Now, if I compare this to 2011, which was a famine year, we are now exceeding the numbers we had then, which were 340,000 children that required treatment at that time.
More than a quarter million people died in the Somali famine of 2011, half of them children under age five. Dagash Kamara says children are dying from a combination of malnutrition and killer diseases such as measles and cholera. She says the drought has killed crops and livestock and dried up water sources. Children are starving and do not have the defenses to fight off the deadly impact of malnutrition and disease. She notes the lives of children in the Horn of Africa also are at increased risk because of the war in Ukraine.
Somalia alone used to import 92% of its wheat from Russia and Ukraine, but supply lines are now blocked. And the war is exacerbating spiraling global food and fuel prices, meaning that many in Ethiopia, Kenya, and Somalia can no longer afford the basic foodstuffs they need to survive.
At the same time, UN agencies are cash poor. They lack the money needed to run their life-saving humanitarian operations. UNICEF has received just a third of its $250 million appeal for the Horn of Africa. The World Food Program says it needs $274 million to scale up life-saving food and nutrition for more than 4 million people in Somalia over the next 6 months. The agencies are appealing for critical support from the G7, which will meet in Germany later this month. They say the G7 advanced countries have it within their power to stave off a catastrophe that need not and must not happen. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Nigerian town of Owo is slowly recovering from the stunning attack on the St. Francis Catholic Church during Sunday Mass, with doctors working on those injured from explosions and gunfire. Authorities have not yet released a death toll, though it has been reported that at least 50 people, including children, died. For an update on the situation, my colleague Douglas Mpuga reached reporter Hassan Umaru Tambuwal at the scene in southwest Nigeria.
Yes. People are still coming out gradually. The problem that it causes higher tension has gone down now because people are out, although businesses and government work like banks, schools, market have not officially opened. But let's say a small work or market people, or like let's say workers, although workers are not out yet, but market has started coming out gradually. You can see some of these specific traders hawking. You can see people flowing out. But if you look at their faces, you see that they are still sad. Most of these people are not moving freely because, you know, the incident that happened is a very serious incident that it may take time before people come to their normal life. Although there's no problem now, it's only in some areas that you cannot see many people, most especially the northern area where northern people are living. But the security are still doing their work. You can see them in the strategic places. They are there with the report, monitoring people, moving up and down.
We hear the police is going on with investigations. What are you hearing from the authorities in as far as the investigation is concerned?
Up to now, the police are going on with the investigation. But there's no actual number of figures from the police officially the people killed. I called the PPRO, Fumilayo, the police public relations officer today. She said up to now they're investigating and the people are doing all what they can do in their offices to see that, yes, they tackle this and catch the culprits and bring them to book. But up to now, they're still insisting on investigation. Whenever you ask police, they will tell you they're investigating. That's what where we are now.
And that was reporter Hassan Umaru Tambuwal speaking with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from OWO. South Africa's language authorities have denounced Irish airline Ryanair for requiring a test in Afrikaans for all South Africans before they can fly to Britain. Afrikaans is spoken by about 12% of South Africans as their first language, and the country boasts 10 other official ones, including the more widely spoken Zulu and Hausa. Singling out Afrikaans also reopens apartheid-era racial wounds, as Vicky Stark reports from Cape Town, South Africa.
VOA asked Dublin-based Ryanair about its test, which is given to South African passport holders travelling in Europe en route to Britain. In response, Ryanair said, due to the high prevalence of fraudulent South African passports, we require passengers travelling to the UK to fill out a simple questionnaire issued in Afrikaans. If they are unable to complete the questionnaire, they will be refused travel and issued with a full refund. The CEO of the Pan-South African Language Board, Lance Schulz, says the board has expressed its displeasure with Ryanair's Afrikaans test because many South Africans do not understand the language.
Our view is that this decision is quite reckless and reminiscent of the apartheid systemic subjugation of speakers of other language, mainly black people. And in essence, our concern is that it creates racial as well as linguistic discrimination. We believe that not just is it in contravening our constitutional democracy as well as linguistic diversity, but it's an ignorance of the UN Declaration on Human Rights.
Schulz says the board believes that Ryanair must find other non-discriminatory means to test South African passports. Meanwhile, the CEO of the Afrikaans Language Council, Dr. Conrad Steenkamp, has written directly to Ryanair to explain how absurd their test is. He says many South Africans would fail a test given in Zulu or one of the other official languages. Steenkamp says he hopes that Ryanair will see the error of its ways.
And thus far, Ryanair has not responded to us about our comments. We advise them to, one, immediately stop using the profiling. Two, they need to start apologizing to people. People were turned back from flights as a result of this. And they are in serious jeopardy. This could end up in court cases.
Reuters reports that the Department of Home Affairs in South Africa said it was taken aback by Ryanair's decision to use the Afrikaans test. The department reportedly said the government had measures that it regularly shares with airlines to curb any instances of fake documents. Ironically, news of Ryanair's Afrikaans test breaks in June when Youth Day is marked in South Africa. The day commemorates the 1976 uprising against the language. On the 16th of this month, 46 years ago, thousands of black students marched in Soweto against the white apartheid government's insistence that Afrikaans be a compulsory medium of instruction in South African schools. Their peaceful protest was met with tear gas and live ammunition fired by police, and it's estimated at least 176 people died in the unrest. Vicky Stark for VOA News, Cape Town, South Africa.
Mali's military government says it will implement a transition to civilian rule in 2024. The government's two-year plan was previously rejected by West African nations, but may be reconsidered at a summit of the regional bloc ECOWAS next month. Annie Risenberg reports from Bamako, Mali.
Mali's military government announced late Monday evening that it has set up a 24-month timeline for transition to civilian rule. Government spokesman Colonel Abdoulaye Maiga made the announcement on state TV station ORTM, appearing for the first time in civilian clothing. The video was posted to the ORTM Facebook page.
La durée de la transition est fixée à 24 mois.
He says the duration of the transition is set at 24 months, starting March 26, 2022. March 26 is a public holiday known as Martyrs' Day in Mali, which pays tribute to the dozens of pro-democracy demonstrators who were killed during the overthrow of dictator Moussa Traoré in 1991. Maiga did not cite a reason for March 26 being chosen as the beginning of the 24-month period. He said the timeline would allow the government to carry out a certain number of institutional political reforms before the organization of elections. The government has previously cited the inability to hold elections in some areas due to insecurity as a reason for extending the transition to civilian rule. Mali's junta, which seized power in a 2020 coup, has been in talks with regional bloc ECOWAS since January, after ECOWAS imposed sanctions on Mali over a government plan to extend the transition until 2026. During an ECOWAS summit in March, Mali's neighbors pushed for a 12 to 16-month timeline. ECOWAS refused to lift the sanctions on Mali after the government proposed a shortened timeline of 24 months. At a meeting last week, ECOWAS leaders decided to discuss the sanctions again at a summit on July 3rd. Maiga said during his address that the government is hopeful the lifting of these sanctions is imminent. Mali is a landlocked state and depends on its West African neighbors for trade. Although the sanctions do not apply to food and fuel, they have hurt Mali's economy, which, like other countries, is dealing with rising prices for food and other necessities. Annie Risenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
Ethiopian authorities have refused to release three detained journalists despite a court order they be given bail. Halima Tumani reports from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Solomon Shumie, Miaza Muhammad, and Temesgen Desalegn appeared before the Federal First Instance Court Tuesday morning and were granted bail of about $190 each. But to their dismay, the Federal Police Force immediately appealed the judge's decision at the High Court. The High Court overruled the lower court's decision and the three journalists were returned to police custody. Their lawyer, Henok Aklilu, tells VOA he was expecting this to happen, but will continue to seek their release.
These things are very much common when politically motivated cases come to courts, especially journalists who are very much critical of the regime. So I was not surprised. You know, they give you a bail in the lower court and it will be overturned by the higher court.
The three journalists are among 19 arrested last month in a crackdown aimed at reporters who have been critical of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's government. The government accuses the journalists of inciting violence and disturbing the country's peace through their work. Henok tells VOA it is now not clear when the journalists will next appear in court.
So we were appealing to the court that there needs to be some reasonable suspicion by the police to arrest someone. But the police, you know, the police are the police, so they come up with all kinds of stories. which are not substantiated by any real evidences.
Authorities have accused Temesgen Desalegn, editor of privately owned Fete magazine, of inciting violence and public disturbance through unspecified interviews published on YouTube. Solomon Shumie, a current affairs talk show host, is accused of inciting violence on his show. It is still not clear what accusations Miaza Muhammad faces. The Committee to Protect Journalists has condemned the arrest of the 19 and called for the Ethiopian government to unconditionally release them. Henock says he has now filed an appeal before the Supreme Court, so the case does not become a criminal matter, but is instead handled under Ethiopia's media proclamation law, which prohibits the detention of journalists. Halima Athmani for VA News, Addis Ababa.
The heads of the armed forces of the East African Community have been meeting in Goma in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo to discuss ways to help bring stability and peace to the troubled region. Reporter Jafar Al-Ketanti is in Goma, and he spoke with my colleague Kate Pondawson about the meeting.
There was here in Goma a three days meeting of all chief of staff of the East African Community region, except Rwanda. And they were talking about how to create a joint force to support FRDC here in DRC in tracking all militia so that DRC can get peace.
What's the motivation for creating some sort of joint force? Why would they do that?
They say it's because without peace, DRC will not develop, and the development of the entire East African region depends by DRC, which has a big potential of economics and everything. So they want to bring peace in DRC so that DRC helps all the region to develop.
Now, I understand this meeting was not organized by the Kinshasa government. Who got this together? Who organized this?
The meeting is not organized by Kinshasa government, but by the East African region. And as the president of Kenya is the president of the EAC, this meeting was organized in DRC, but by the chief of staff of Kenyan army. And he's the one who was the lead at the meeting.
You mentioned earlier that the Kigali government, the Rwandan military, was not represented. Do we know why the Rwandan chief of staff was not there?
No one knows why Rwanda was not here at the meeting. And we didn't yet ask to the Rwandan government to let us know why they didn't respond the call from the EAC meeting.
That was Jafar Al-Ketanti, a journalist in Goma. He was speaking with VOA's Kate Bondawson. About 1,533 personnel from the East African Community member states are taking part in a joint military training exercise in Uganda with a focus on cooperation and security operations in the region. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
Currently underway in three Ugandan districts, the exercise has attracted army, police, and prison personnel from the six member states, including Uganda, Burundi, Kenya, Tanzania, Rwanda, and South Sudan. The newest member to the bloc, the Democratic Republic of Congo, only sent a team of 10 observers. Major General Don Nabasa is the commander of the Uganda People's Defense Forces, UPDF Military Police, and director of the joint training. He says it's aimed at testing the EAC's readiness to jointly tackle emerging security threats such as armed conflicts, transnational crime, and terror threats.
The exercise is based on four thematic areas, which include peace support operations, counter-terrorism, counter-piracy, and disaster management. The expected outcome of this exercise include jointly managed integrated mission headquarters capable of planning and executing missions jointly, integrated service support architecture, among many others.
Lieutenant General Peter Erelu is the Deputy Chief of UPDF. He has tasked the ESC security organs to work jointly to protect the region's resources from exploitation.
This exercise is very important for us in the East African community, because if we don't do that, some people are going to swallow us. There are some hyenas around watching, because we have so many good things around. We have this water, we have minerals. Some people envy this very much. So if we sleep, they will take over.
Gaspard Banyakimbona is the executive secretary of ESC's Inter-University Council. He notes that the exercise should strengthen information sharing about possible threats in the region and discuss how to combat them.
East African Defense Forces have gone beyond exercises and are operating together in several missions, such as in the African Union Transition Mission in Somalia, and consequently, the objectives of this field training exercise include, among others, to enhance interoperability between the ESC partner states, defense force, and other key stakeholders, and to practice the ESC standing operating procedures for peace support operations, disaster management, and counter-terrorism and counter-piracy operations.
Lydia Wanyoto, the head of mission for the exercise, told the media in Kampala that the training is a good gesture toward fostering cohesion and integration among ESC member states.
When you see these exercises, they are meant to be opening up a progressive cross-border ideological understanding and approach to many things, including peace and security. We are using the competences we have of human diplomacy, because that's where our strength is, our cultural values, our history. We are neighbors, don't let the borders divide us. We speak the same language. The strength of who we are is what we are using in terms of military diplomacy and security.
The joint training is conducted every 2 years on a rotational basis among the member states. It was last held in 2018 in Tanzania. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
We have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There you'll find all our favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more, so find us on voaafrica.com. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat.
African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bongo flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05